All right. Hello, everybody. It's Ale Cheka again. And I'm here again with Allison, Dr. Allison Rutledge.
Hello.
So last time we had this wonderful conversation about Elizabeth Barrett Browning and Aurora Leigh.
Yep.
Which is amazing.
Yep.
And that wasn't even what we were going to talk about. So we were going to talk about Vernon Leigh.
Yeah.
And if I may, I would like to pepper you with a whole bunch of questions.
Please do.
Okay.
Please do.
Who is Vernon Leigh?
Who is Vernon Leigh? That is a great question. So she was a writer, lived in the late 19th, early 20th century. She was born in like the 1860s, and lived basically until the 1930s. So kind of, she's one of those people who I'm really interested in because she kind of falls in between time periods, where she is sort of on the older end of Victorianism and but a little bit too old for the modernists. And so she kind of falls between, like, she kind of crosses the boundary of time periods in literature, and as a result, I think has kind of like fallen by the wayside in people's knowledge about her. So,
well, I definitely had never heard of her before. Yep. you kind of brought her into my mm-hmm. consciousness. And I just want to share, I'm holding in my hands your Christmas gift.
Yes.
From your dad.
Yes.
Which is a book by Vernon Leigh, and it's called Gospels of Anarchy.
Yes.
Which is like a pretty amazing title.
Yeah, she's pretty good at titles, I think.
I just want to share the chapter titles because I feel like this gives right away a flavor of why this is a person.
And there's the dedication to H.G. Wells.
H.G. Wells.
Who she was friends with for a little bit. They corresponded for a while, and then inevitably they had a falling out because she always managed to have falling outs with people. She was kind of an abrasive person, and so she would like get really close to somebody and then do something to make them really mad.
I can't relate to that at all.
I haven't experienced that with you. You're a lovely person.
I actually have very lovely relationships with all my friends.
There you go.
But I can relate to being a little bit abrasive. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I can give you examples later if you want.
So, so these are the chapter titles.
Yeah.
Which I fell in love with this the second I saw it.
Yep.
The chapter titles of her, this is just a book that I have in front of me. Chapter 1, Gospels of Anarchy. Chapter 2, Emerson is a Teacher of Latter-day Tendencies. Chapter 3, and this is my favorite, Deterioration of the Soul. You know, I'm super into this one. And then there's a couple here that just, the economic parasitism of mm-hmm. women. Ruskin is a reformer. Nietzsche and the Will to Power, Tolstoy on Art. So she just sounds like a very learned.
Yes, absolutely.
And opinionated lady.
Indeed. And so I should say that her birth name was Violet Paget. She took the name Vernon Leigh as her pen name, but she also went by it in real life. I mean, like, her, and I know this book, like, from reading biographies of her, but also I've done a lot of work in reading her letters, mm-hmm. and depending on who she's writing to, they would call her Vernon, or they would call her mom would call her Violet. And there was like this one funny letter that I was reading where she went to a party and she was getting introduced, and I guess she was getting introduced as Violet. This was like very early in her career where she was still using that name more. And this poet, Augusta Webster, who was kind of a big deal in the late 19th century, she wrote lots of dramatic monologues. Yeah. Have you ever read anything by her?
No.
Oh, you should. She's great. It was lots of like...
You had me at dramatic monologues.
So she wrote a lot like Robert Browning's dramatic monologues, mm-hmm. But often from the viewpoints of women. Mm-hmm. So she met Augusta Webster, and then after the party, I guess somebody told Augusta Webster, oh, that was Vernon Leigh. And so then Augusta Webster, like, visited her the next day and was like, I didn't realize you were Vernon Leigh. I love your work. And so, this name thing was kind of kept her incognito for a while. But she was also, she was throughout her, one relationship she did maintain was she was very close to John Singer Sargent.
Oh!
They were childhood friends.
No kidding!
They met in Rome.
I love John Singer Sargent.
And they were friends forever. Yes.
Did he paint her?
Yes.
Where is it?
I don't know where it is.
Okay.
I've only seen it online. I haven't seen the painting in person.
We obviously have to go see it.
Sure. It's great. I mean, and it's a good representation of her presentation. Mm-hmm. So I guess today we would probably say that she was genderqueer. Mm. So she wore what was at the time called very masculine clothing, and that she wore lots of like dark black, lots of like collared shirts. Mm-hmm. I think she had a lot of her clothes like custom made because she didn't want to wear like the flouncy fashions of the time.
This is so interesting to me because I think when I think of women wearing masculine clothing, I automatically picture like somebody wearing pants.
Right.
But this isn't somebody wearing pants. Like,
no.
There's all kinds of kind of subtext with the colors and with the cut of things.
Yeah, yeah. It's part of why sometimes people think of her as a movement from the time period called the New Woman. Are you familiar with this?
A little bit.
And dress was a part of this. Mm-hmm. And so...
Like, did she wear a corset?
I don't know. It's a good question. But in all the images I've seen of her... she is wearing a skirt, but it's just all very plain. There's no bustles. There's no ruffles. There's no lace. It's just all very severe.
This is just so interesting to me because when I think of a Sargent painting, mm-hmm. it's very society lady. Mm-hmm. You know, you got your Madame X and
it's just like from like. Collarbone up. It's not a full length portrait, you know. And she's got her spectacles on. So this is
a very like deliberate persona that she would put on.
Absolutely.
Like the name.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
That's really interesting.
It was definitely a And I should say that one of the things interesting about this time period is mm-hmm. that there's this like sort of movement to understand the variety of human sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
There's this guy named Havelock Ellis, mm-hmm. who was one of the first people to try to sort of suss out different sexual orientations,
mm-hmm.
at least in England. And she was the example that he used for his chapter on lesbianism.
Really?
Yes.
So she was the poster child.
Yes. So she had lots of romantic relationships with women.
This is fascinating. Okay, so she had this, like, very masculine appearance.
Mm-hmm.
She is the chapter on lesbianism in this guy's book.
Yep.
And then she was a writer.
Yeah.
So tell me about her writing. Because I started reading, and I kind of didn't finish, but I'm very excited to finish. Is it The Phantom Lady?
So it's called The Phantom Lover.
The Phantom Lover.
And its alternate title is Oak of Oakhurst.
Okay.
Yeah. And I should say, I absolutely recognize that her writing style is very verbose.
Yeah, but that's a selling point.
Well, and part of that is, like, she really admired Henry James. She loved him. And they were like...
If you had told me that at the outset, I would never have picked up this woman. Because I can't even contain in words how much I dislike Henry James. One of my classmates once refers to reading Henry James like digging a ditch with a teaspoon.
It's very accurate.
I feel like that's... But I wasn't getting a Henry James vibe from at least the introduction. I was getting more of a... Like a... Not like an Ethan Frome. I actually was still in a very Bronte mindset because you had like the manor house and the country, and
she was also very good friends with Edith Wharton.
Get out.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, Edith Wharton would come visit her at her villa in Florence.
Okay. Well, see.
Yeah.
See. Then this is making a lot of sense. John Singer Sargent.
Yep. Yep.
Edith Wharton.
Yep.
The whole set.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So,
this is very interesting.
And I should say she really admired Henry James early on, like mm-hmm. early in her career, like in the 1880s. And then she wrote a short story that was a thinly veiled portrayal of Henry James called Lady Tall. And he got very angry with her and cut off all relationship.
Podcast cannot fully capture my face, but again, side eye.
Yeah.
Because that's how I feel about Henry James. Although I could see, all right, from what I had read so far, I could see the introduction of Miss Oakhurst being a little bit like, what's her face, Lily.
Mm-hmm.
Lily, I mean, because what's her face from Henry James is always described in this very, like, painterly way.
Right.
And here you have, like, an actual painter describing this woman
in right.
like, very
right.
aesthetic terms.
Right. Absolutely.
Which is, okay, I guess that's also interesting now knowing that she was a lesbian, because it's like, pretty objectifying.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
that we get so much about what Miss Oakhurst looks like, physically looks like,
right.
before we get any of her, like, speaking or personality right. or anything like that.
Right. Yeah, and the thing I like about that I guess it's a novella, it's kind of a long short story, mm-hmm. Is that by the end it kind of becomes, it is a story about Alice Oak,
mm-hmm.
but it's also really a story about the narrator, the painter, and
yeah.
sort of how he sees her and what he is looking for
mm-hmm.
artistically
mm-hmm.
and the value that he places on different artistic qualities.
So, like, a couple of things that jumped out to me.
Mm-hmm.
One, not knowing anything about Vernon Lee,
mm-hmm.
she hadn't been, like, a very well-educated person, because there's all these, like, little Shakespearean
yeah.
touches.
Yeah.
You know, like, the first paragraph is,
uh-huh.
everything is, like, stale and unprofitable, just,
right.
like, right out of Hamlet, and something is, like, hiding behind an heiress,
uh-huh.
which is very,
uh-huh.
like, Polonius or whatever. And then he's also very, like, the painter, I mean, is, like, a little bit snarky.
Yeah.
So there's just, like, the reason that he so I guess, like, the outset of the story is that there's a painter, and the painter goes to this house.
Yep.
Because he's been commissioned by the husband,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Oak, to paint the wife.
Yep.
Alice Oak.
Mm-hmm.
But, the way that he sets it up is that he has to take the commission.
Yep.
Because he has painted an overweight woman, and she doesn't find the portrait very flattering.
Yeah.
And he just says flat out, like, well, it wasn't flattering because I just painted her exactly what she
yeah.
looks like. You know, so,
yeah.
so, like, there's not, like, a super sympathetic, you know, thing to say, but it's also, like, it's funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, like, all the society biddies,
right.
like, nobody wants her. So I guess he's, like, the anti sergeant, because sergeant makes everybody look good.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So when he goes out to this house, he's just convinced that it's going to be so boring.
Right.
And why did I, you know, why did I ever sign up for this?
Right.
And then he sees Alice and,
uh-huh.
and she's just, you know,
right. well,
amazing.
First he sees the house.
He sees the house and he thinks the husband's dippy.
Yeah. He's not interested in the husband at all.
Yeah, and the husband does seem kind of dippy.
Yeah. I like that passage that you mentioned where he's like in the carriage or whatever going mm-hmm. to the house and he's just imagining... this very, like, conventional Victorian home that he's going to go to. And he lists off all these objects
yes.
that are going to be in the house and,
yes.
and all the children who are going to be running around. And it's just, like, all of this, like, stuff that you would buy. And I think he even, like, name drops, like, Liberties, maybe. Which
yeah.
And then he gets there and he's like, oh, no, this is, like, a Renaissance home and like
I underlined that bit because
yeah.
I didn't recognize any of the stuff, but I felt like this is like he was telegraphing what we would describe maybe as somebody very basic. Like, I'm gonna get there's gonna be like a
yeah.
pumpkin spice candle
yep.
and you're gonna have like your Uggs and
yeah.
then like, you know,
she's gonna
like,
be so basic.
She's gonna be so basic.
And then
yeah.
he gets there and he's like, oh, she's so artistic and interesting.
Yeah, she's deep.
Yeah, she's like so obsessed with the Renaissance.
He's a hipster. He's
yeah,
a hipster.
Absolutely.
And he does not want to be going. Yeah.
Well, and the hipsters
yes.
of this time period
yes.
were the aesthetes.
Yes.
So, and that's kind of what
mm-hmm.
she's making fun of.
Well, I mean, the other vibe that I was getting there is that this paragraph is basically a big eye roll towards every Jane Austen novel.
Oh.
Like, I'm going to get there and there's going to be like, the society
yeah.
garden party sort of
mm-hmm,
thing.
Mm-hmm.
And God, you know, I can't think of anything like more basic or whatever. And then you get there like, oh, this isn't Jane Austen. I'm all of a sudden in like
right.
Thornfield.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's interesting, my kind of theory on it is that, and this is kind of based on some of other stuff by Vernon Lee, is that she's in this kind of interesting place where she like admires what the aesthetes like Oscar Wilde are trying to do in like, you know, being sort of hipster and counterculture or whatever. But she also sees that they are also, like, they're not breaking out of a trend. They're just, like, creating their own aesthetic.
Do you know,
that is trendy.
I have a new theory.
Yeah.
I have a new theory. I think that the painter guy, he is Branwell Bronte. I think that's exactly what Branwell Bronte would have been in real life.
Sure.
And he was also a painter.
Yeah.
Just, like, these people are just beneath my notice. Because I'm so busy, like, heavily drinking and being cool.
Yeah.
When actually, like... Dang. Okay.
But yeah.
So what happens in the story?
Okay, so the painter goes. He sees Alice Oak. And she is... He is obsessed with her. And she is beautiful, but she's beautiful in a weird way.
Yeah.
Right? Like, she's kind of, like, detached from everything. Mm-hmm. She kind of floats around and, like, lives in her own little world.
She doesn't seem very into him.
No. She, like, doesn't care about him. Mm-hmm. And she has this one room in the house, the yellow room. You haven't got to this point.
No. Okay. Yeah.
And she is obsessed with, Alice Oak is obsessed with her ancestor, another Alice Oak from the 16th century. No, 17th century.
Okay.
And...
Is there a painting with a rough? Tell me there's a painting with a rough.
Yes.
There is a painting with a rough?
Okay. Yeah. And so there's paintings. You know, she will often, like, put up... They still have, like, some clothes of this ancestor that she will, like, dress herself in 17th century garb. She likes the yellow room because it has, like, lots of decorations from that time period. And the story is that this ancestor, Alice Oak, the former, was married and to the, you know, her husband, Mr. Oak, from the 17th century. But she took up with this, I think he was a poet. Yeah, but an artist.
Yeah.
And
we're talking like Elizabethan time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool.
They're like, they had this like illicit affair, and then the husband found out, and they were gonna like, basically the story was that Alice Oak and her lover killed her husband, and then they like ran off together, and she like dressed up in man's clothing, and they like took a cart and like ran away.
Oh my gosh.
And so the present day Alice Oak is obsessed with this ancestor.
Yeah.
And it becomes kind
of... Wait, hang on. How is she the descendant?
Because they're cousins.
Okay.
She married her cousin. Okay. Yes. Because, and this is always disconcerting to students.
Yeah.
When you say, yeah, people married their cousins.
Yeah, but they all married their cousins.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so she married her cousin, and so they're both descendants of this person. Mm-hmm. And her husband thinks that it's this, like, shameful family story.
Right.
And he's, like, so embarrassed that his wife is so obsessed with it. Mm-hmm. And that she, like, there's, like, scenes where she likes to tell this story at dinner parties. And he's so embarrassed, and she, like, thinks it's the most amazing story ever.
Right.
Okay, and so she's obsessed with this ancestor, and it kind of becomes unclear. Does she think she is the reincarnation of her ancestor? Is she being, like, possessed by the ghost of her ancestor? And then there's, like, there might be a ghost of her dead lover, the poet, haunting the house.
Wait, so what's the dynamic between her and the husband? Is she gonna try and kill the husband because of the possession?
It's kind of, like, she really likes, like, tormenting him, with, like, her behavior. Like, he finds her behavior really, embarrassing, and when she starts acting all 17th century, he finds it, like, really...
This is very Heathcliff, Catherine, and Linton.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Like, Linton is never gonna be cool enough for the cool kids.
Absolutely not, yeah. So, and over the course of the story, right, that this painter is just, like, there watching this happen, and he's painting, by the way, he's painting her in the yellow room, because when she's in the yellow room, she just looks so beautiful and interesting, and he basically, like, the painter does stuff to try to, like, provoke her, and to, like, keep encouraging her in her quote-unquote delusion, which is what her husband thinks.
Right.
And so there's this, like, ethical question about, like, mm-hmm. you know, okay, there's this question about, is it something supernatural happening? Mm-hmm. Is she, like, a reincarnation or possessed? Or is there also a ghost in the yellow room? Mm-hmm. Or is she just mad? And if she's mad, is the painter basically encouraging her delusions by... And he's sort of doing, like, encouraging her delusions in order to get the best painting possible of her. Anyway, so, mm-hmm. would you like me to spoil it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
No, I want to know.
Okay. So, all this happens, all this weird dynamics, and the painter is, like, becoming really obsessed with her, mm-hmm. And with painting her, and... it's kind of unclear whether he is also going slightly mad.
Well, I was going to say, I'm fixating a little bit on the... So it says at the outset of the story that he doesn't have a painting of her.
Right.
What he has are these old sketches.
Right.
So I'm fixating a little bit on the fact that there is a painting of the ancestor?
Yes.
So... I don't know. Like, he's... who is it that's trying to recreate these
right.
this aesthetic moment? It's weird. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm interrupting.
No, it's fine. Yeah, yeah. So by the end, the husband keeps getting angrier and angrier that she, mm-hmm. you know, consists in this delusion. And also, by the way, I should add that part of the problem with what is going on with Alice Oak is that because she is so obsessed with her ancestor, mm-hmm. She is not fulfilling her wifely duties.
No, of course not.
Yeah, she's not, like, you know, hosting people. She's not having kids.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of the problem.
Right.
So he gets angrier and angrier and angrier, and by the end of the story, he, like, one day, she's in the yellow room, and there's, like, some French doors with, like, windows mm-hmm. on them to this room. He's out in the garden. He looks into the windows, and he sees the figure of a man in the yellow room.
Oh!
And he is convinced that it is mm-hmm. this ghost of the lover of the dead Alice Oak.
Yeah.
And so he bursts into the room.
Uh-huh.
And of course there's nobody there except for Alice. And he shoots at what he thinks is this man or the ghost that's in there. And he shoots his wife. She dies. And then he, in remorse, the next day commits suicide.
Wait. What?
Yes, that is the story.
No, wait. Hang on.
Yes.
Hang on. He goes into the room. Mm. Is she dressed?
No.
Like, is she dressed in a way that makes her look like a man, like the dead lover?
I don't think so.
Or he just sees a figure.
He thinks he sees a man in the room with his wife. And he shoots at the man and ends up shooting his wife.
So, does this count as them fulfilling the...
Yes,
the, like, the dark... Because the husband... Wait, what? Okay, hang on. So in the original, like, the ancestors scenario, yeah. the husband kills the wife and the lover?
No, they kill the husband.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
They kill the husband.
Yeah.
But in, like, the modern
yeah.
iteration, the husband kills, weirdly, the wife and the lover.
Uh-huh.
But really, it's just the wife, because there is no lover.
And then himself. Yeah. And then the painter is just like, yeah, all this happened. And it's sort of, and so of course, you know,
yeah.
it's all unresolved. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, what was the husband driven insane?
Mm-hmm.
And therefore he was hallucinating. Mm-hmm. Did he actually see the ghost? We don't know.
That is a crazy story.
I agree.
I enjoyed that very much.
Good.
Wait, so are all her stories like this?
No. But she did write a whole bunch of...
This is very Wilkie Collins.
Yeah. So she did write a whole bunch of these supernatural stories, or mm-hmm. sort of ambiguously supernatural stories.
Right.
And so this one, as well as a couple of others, were in a collection named Hauntings.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of other crazy stories, like similar kinds of stuff, like very, like, lots of, like, dramatic romance and possible ghost hauntings and people, you know, being driven to terrible acts by their passion.
One of the things I find interesting here is that, like, a lot of these stories, the end point is the marriage or not marriage.
Mm.
And this one, that's off the table.
Yeah.
Because they're already married.
Right.
And so the resolution isn't mm-hmm. going to be that they fall in love, right? They don't fall in love, or they end up together.
Right.
Which I guess there's not a whole lot of ways for that to have gone. Wait, so the painter here, he's not in love with anybody. He's just like an obsessed observer.
Yeah, sort of.
And then he leaves and he has this crazy story.
Yeah, and I think, like, the frame story is sort of that he...
I told you that story that one time.
Yeah, or that, like, I think if I remember correctly, it opens with somebody coming into his studio and mm-hmm. seeing, like, this woman, or, like, these unfinished sketches and attempts at painting this woman. And then they're like, what's going on here? Are you obsessed with her? He's like, yeah, but I can't do it because I couldn't finish the perfect portrait.
Well, it lays it on so thick on how her beauty isn't in her stillness.
Right.
Like, it's in the way she moves. And that she actually looks odd.
Yes.
That she's, like, kind of... It says that she's, like, straight like bamboo.
Yes.
And that she's stooped a little bit.
Yeah.
But her beauty is in, like, her movements.
Yeah.
Which is, like... I mean, you right. can't capture that,
of course.
In the painting. Oh, this is a good story.
I agree. Yeah. But, yeah, I think one of the things that Vernon Lee is... And she does write more, like... realist stories mm-hmm. As well, and she has one of her novels that she wrote that is probably one of my favorites. Is called Lewis Norbert.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of takes some of the themes from these supernatural stories, which are often about, like, you know, this questions about, like, art and artistic value and artistic obsession mm-hmm. or obsession with history or the past or a romanticization of the past.
Yeah.
She kind of casts it into a more realistic setting where it's basically a historical detective story
mm-hmm.
Where an archaeologist and Lady Venetia Hammond are...
That's a great...
I know, it's so great.
It's a great name.
Lady Venetia Hammond are trying to solve the historical mystery of this man named Lewis Norbert, whose portrait hangs on the wall of her family estate.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to determine who he really was. And again, he was from the 17th century. She was a little bit obsessed. Vernon Lee.
Well, it puts another layer onto that Ruskin chapter.
Yeah.
That we were set, because it's very, like, pre-Raphaelite to,
right.
like, over and over again try and
yeah.
recreate
yeah.
this, like...
Yeah.
mythic past.
Yes.
Okay, what happened to Vernon Lee? Because what you're describing to me is that she runs in these, like, pretty high literary
yeah.
circles, that she's well known enough in her time
mm-hmm.
that she has to, like, go around incognito and people are coming up to her parties.
Yeah.
But I've never heard of her.
Yeah.
So what happened?
So there are a lot of theories on this. And one of them is that she so that she has a lot of stuff working against her.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is that she kind of... She worked in multiple genres, right?
Mm-hmm.
We talked about her short stories.
Yeah.
She wrote novels. She also was a very prolific essayist. Like, this book here is,
yeah.
is just, like, intellectual, cultural essays type
right.
of thing. She wrote travel writing, which
mm-hmm.
I am really interested in. And so she doesn't really get classified as, like... you know, one thing or the other. She's too, like, diverse or something
mm-hmm.
for like, you know, people who specialize in novels to, like, say, oh,
mm-hmm.
she's a great novelist. She's not a great novelist. She's an interesting novelist, but...
Yeah.
Anyway, she also, as I was saying, I think she kind of falls in between time periods.
Mm.
And so, you know, she doesn't represent Victorianism exactly.
No, yeah.
And she doesn't really represent the modernists mm-hmm. because she has too much of the Victorians in the way that she writes and stuff like that. So... you know, things persist because they get taught, because they fit into our model or understanding of how literary history, and she doesn't
yeah.
really fit the model of that these are two distinct time periods and never the two shall meet.
Yeah.
You know?
And then you said she was kind of abrasive too.
She was also, yeah. And so she had lots of relationships with other prominent writers and artists that often ended in disaster because she would say something to them in person, or she would write a story about them that they didn't like. Like the Henry James story. Yeah. She also did this with her first novel, where she sort of wrote a satire of the Pre-Raphaelites.
Yeah, which would deserve it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And she was basically critiquing, which was pretty fair critique, that a lot of times they would kind of romanticize poverty.
Yes!
And she's like, yeah, maybe we should do that. And should, like, you know, see these people as real people, and maybe we should, like, really help them as opposed to just making pretty paintings of them. And they didn't like that mm-hmm. portrayal. And so she got completely, like, ostracized from the London Literary Society.
I used to like the Pre-Raphaelites, and then I read a quadruple biography of these four sisters, and one of them was the wife of Edward Burne Jones.
Yep.
And, like, the whole thing was such mm-hmm. a dumpster fire.
That yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It put me off.
The whole plot is basically, like, yeah. The main character, Miss Brown, essentially gets... It's kind of a Pygmalion story. Like, mm-hmm. a poet, painter, Dante Rossetti type goes and, like, rescues this beautiful peasant girl.
I cannot explain why, because it's just, like, the most anti-feminist thing possible, but I love Pygmalion. love them. Have seen every single, like, Pygmalion teen plot movie mm-hmm. that has ever been. It's, like, it's my soft spot. She's All That.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
It's my soft spot, but it's, like, horrifying in real life.
I mean, there's probably a reason why they're so popular.
Do you know what the best one is?
Mm.
The best one is, Working Girl.
Yes.
From the 80s.
Yep.
Because there's no Pygmalion. She just makes over herself.
Yeah. That's great. Actually, that's a good point.
Yeah. I love that one. Okay. So Vernon Lee.
Yeah. So she had a talent for making people not like her at a certain point. And then she also, what I think is probably a big deal too, during World War I, she was a pacifist, and she mm-hmm. wrote, like, very vehement anti-war like op-eds and like really ostracize a lot of people because
I have to say when you said that she was abrasive, I was kind of waiting to hear that she like entertainingly offended people, but it sounds like she kind of accurately lampooned people that sort of deserve to be lampooned a little bit.
Yeah, I think so, but you know, apparently
that's not the most politic.
Yeah, it's thing. Not and yeah, it's not the best way to like get people to review your books positively. And
yeah. Well, all right. Well, we got to wrap up.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for doing two episodes.
I mean, I could talk all the time about books.
Seriously,
so.
This is awesome. This is awesome. I could listen to you all day talk about books.
Oh, thanks.
But I think hopefully we are convincing the world to give Vernon Lee a second look.
Yeah, you should.
It was amazing. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.